We have been making our way through some of the women in the Old Testament. We've looked at Miriam and Rahab and Tamar and Ruth. And who did we look at last week? Deborah and Jael and the tent peg. And today we look at the story of Hannah. So chapter 1 of 1 Samuel.
Page 264 of the Old Testament. Elkanah and his family at Shiloh. There was a man named Elkanah from the tribe of Ephraim who lived in the town of Ramah in the hill country of Ephraim. He was the son of Jeroham and grandson of Elihu and belonged to the family of Tohu, a part of the clan of Saph. Elkanah had two wives, Hannah and Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had none. Every year, Elkanah went to the Ramah to worship and offer sacrifices to the Lord Almighty at Shiloh, where Hophni and Phinehas, the two sons of Eli, were priests of the Lord. Each time Elkanah offered his sacrifice, he would give one share of the meat to Peninnah and one share to each of her children. Even though he loved Hannah very much, he would give her only one share because the Lord had kept her from having children. Peninnah, her rival, would torment and humiliate her because the Lord had kept her childless. This went on year after year. Whenever they went to the house of the Lord, Peninnah would upset Hannah so much that she would cry and refuse to eat anything. Her husband, Elkanah, would ask her, "Hannah, why are you crying? Why won't you eat? Why are you always so sad? Don't I mean more to you than 10 sons? One day, after they had finished their meal in the house of the Lord at Shiloh, Hannah got up. She was deeply distressed, and she cried bitterly as she prayed to the Lord. Meanwhile, Eli the priest was sitting in his place by the door. Hannah made a solemn promise. "Almighty Lord, look at me, your servant. See my trouble and remember me. Don't forget me. If you give me a son, I promise that I would dedicate him to you for his whole life and that he will never have his hair cut." Hannah continued to pray to the Lord for a long time, and Eli watched her lips. She was praying silently. Her lips were moving, but she made no sound. So Eli thought that she was drunk and said to her, "Stop making a drunken show of yourself. Stop your drinking and sober up." "No, I'm not drunk, sir," she answered. "I haven't been drinking. I am desperate, and I have been praying, pouring out my troubles to the Lord. Don't think I am a worthless woman. I have been praying like this because I am so miserable." "Go in peace," Eli said, "and may the God of Israel give you what you have asked him for." "May you always think kindly of me," she replied. Then she went away, ate some food, and was no longer sad. Samuel's birth and dedication. The next morning, Elkanah and his family got up early, and after worshipping the Lord, they went back home to Ramah. Elkanah had intercourse with his wife Hannah, and the Lord answered her prayer. So it was with that she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Samuel and explained, "I asked the Lord for him." The time came again to Elkanah and his family to go to Shiloh and offer for the Lord the yearly sacrifice and the special sacrifice he had promised. But this time Hannah did not go. She told her husband, "As soon as the child is weaned, I will take him to the house of the Lord, where he will stay all his life." Elkanah answered, "All right, do whatever you think is best. Stay at home until you have weaned him, and may the Lord make you, your promise, come true. So Hannah stayed at home and nursed her child. After she had weaned him, she took him to Shiloh, taking along a 3-year-old bull, 10 kilograms of flour, a leather bag full of wine. She took Samuel, young as he was, to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. After they had killed the bull, they took the child to Eli. Hannah said to him, "Excuse me, sir, do you remember me? I am the woman you saw standing here praying to the Lord. I asked him for this child, and he gave me what I asked for. So I am dedicating him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he will belong to the Lord." Then they worshipped the Lord there. Then, at the beginning of chapter 2, Hannah's song from the Message. I'm bursting with good news. I'm walking on air. I'm laughing at my rivals. I'm dancing my salvation. Nothing and no one is holy like God. No rock, mountain like our God. Don't dare talk pretentiously. Not a word of boasting ever, for God knows what's going on. He takes the measure of everything that happens. The weapons of the strong are smashed to pieces, while the weak are infused with fresh strength. The well-fed are out begging in the streets for crusts, while the hungry are getting second helpings. The barren woman has a house full of children, while the mother of many is bereft. God brings death to God, brings life, brings down to the grave and raises up. God brings poverty and God brings wealth. He lowers, he also lifts up. He puts poor people on their feet again. He rekindles burned out lives with fresh hope, restoring dignity and respect to their lives, a place in the sun. For the very structures of earth are God's. He has laid out his operations on a firm foundation. He protectively cares for his faithful friends step by step, but leaves the wicked to stumble in the dark. No one makes it in this life by sheer muscle. God's enemy will be blasted out of the sky, crushed in a heap and burned. God will set things right all over the earth. He'll give strength to his king. He'll set his anointed on top of the world. Thank you for the word. Amen.
Let's pray together. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. I didn't plan it this way, but it seems appropriate on a Sunday when we watched a video of disabled children who have been abandoned that we talk about the issue of being a mother, and particularly the story of Hannah. I wonder for a moment who you think is the most powerful person in the world. Is his name Donald? And his surname Trump? Does that fill you with comfort, despair, anxiety? Or maybe it's somebody else. Maybe it's somebody like Bill Gates, who has had such enormous influence on us day by day without us even sometimes realizing it. Or maybe you have others. President Theodore Roosevelt was US president in the early part of the 20th century. And he said this, "When all is said, it is the mother who does her part in rearing and training aright the boys and girls who are to be the men and women of the next generation. It is she who is the greater use to our community. If she would only realize it, a more honorable as well as a more important position than any man in it, she is more important by far than a successful statesman, businessman, artist, or scientist." That was perhaps in the day where you didn't get many women who were stateswomen and state and businesswomen and artists and scientists. And I think he was right. For mothers are the most important, the most powerful people in the world, for they are the ones, more than anyone else, who mould us in our most mouldable years. Today is the anniversary of my mother's death, and therefore it seems appropriate again that I should talk about motherhood. For she was a deeply loving mother who looked after 5 children that weren't her own and 2 of her own. But in our culture in these days, we often ignore or downplay the fact that mothers are the most important. Tony Campolo, an American writer and speaker, says in one of his books, too many women are made to feel that they should apologize for being mothers or housewives. I don't like the name housewives. I think they should be called homemakers. In reality, such roles can be noble callings. He goes on. When I was on the faculty of a university, there were gatherings from time to time to which faculty members brought their spouses. Inevitably, some woman doctor or sociologist would confront my wife with the question, "And what do you do, my dear?" My wife, who has given her life to raise our 2 sons, and who, by the way, is one of the most brilliantly articulate individuals I know, had a great response. She would say, "I am socializing 2 Homo sapiens in the dominant values of the Judeo-Christian tradition, in order that they might be instruments of the transformation of the social order in the teleologically prescribed utopia inherent in the eschaton." And then she would follow that with, "And what is it that you do?" The other person's response wasn't that overpowering. Now, of course, there is absolutely nothing wrong with women who are doctors or lawyers or sociologists, but women who choose to focus their time and energies being a mother have nothing to be ashamed of. Mothers are of absolute value, and their worth is never done. Well, in our study of women of the Old Testament, this morning we focus on an extraordinary mother, her name, Hannah. She was the mother of the prophet. She is first mentioned in the beginning of the book of Samuel. She lived during the time in the history of Israel when the age of the judges came to the end. Remember last week we looked at Deborah in the book of Judges. And you'll remember that I referred to the book of Judges like the gunk in the U-bend. It tells of the period of cycles in which the Hebrew people rebelled against God, began to worship the pagan gods around them, suffered the painful consequences, cried out to God for help, and he responded by sending a judge who would deliver them. For a while they would return to God, but when the judge died, the people would rebel against God, and the cycle would begin all over again. This cycle repeated itself 7 times. And when these cycles came to an end, Israel was nothing more than a loosely organized federation of tribal territories, scarcely able to keep the Philistines, their enemies, at bay. But as 1 Samuel begins, a new era is about to dawn. In Judges it said that everyone did what was right in their own eyes, for Israel had no king. But now, there is hope. In Samuel's day, Israel would have a king. This nation would become unified under the rule of the monarchs of King Saul and King David and King Solomon. And our reading today tells the story of the events that led to the birth of Samuel, the man who God used more than any other to begin this new era in the life of Israel. His father, Elkanah, a name that means God has created a son. Elkanah must have been a man of some means because he had 2 wives. Think of all those shoes. His first wife, Hannah, was his true love. But as years passed, it became obvious that she was barren. And it was a burning desire of every couple in those days to have children, especially male children, so that the husband's family line could go on. Now, I know there are people here who have faced the agony of not being able to have children. Some thought that that was the case and then had their miracle baby. And some adopted children. No doubt there are many of you who know how Hannah must have felt. But what made it even worse for her was the fact that she lived in a culture in which childbearing was seen as pretty much the sole reason for a woman's existence. Since Hannah was unable to have children, Elkanah took a second wife named Peninnah. She wasn't barren. In fact, she seemed to have had a baby every time she turned around, just as regularly as the seasons there came a new son or daughter into the family, so that the house was filled with children. But none of them were Hannah's. The ache in Hannah's heart deepened as time went by. And the final wrench of agony, of course, was that Peninnah could not keep quiet about her fertility. She found 1,001 ways to remind Hannah of her inadequacy. Peninnah taunted Hannah and mocked her, and every word was like a knife that plunged deeply into her heart. Well, three times a year, all Israelite men were required to be at the most important sanctuary to offer sacrifices in observance of the main religious festivals. These were held in Shiloh, which was located about 60 miles east of Elkanah's home in Ramah. It was a town in which the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant were located. And the festival mentioned in the first chapter of 1 Samuel was probably the Feast of Tabernacles, which was celebrated in the autumn. Festival celebrations like this were times of rejoicing in God's blessings, especially that of a bountiful harvest. And when Elkanah's family arrived, he followed the custom of his people and distributed a portion of the sacrificial meat to Peninnah and to each of her children. But she provided Hannah with double portions because of her great love, because of the great love he had for her. But in spite of this favored status, Hannah's misery, her depression over not being able to have children, continued and peaked while they were at Shiloh for the festival. In fact, one day when they were fasting and praying for a child, she made a vow to God that if he would only give her a son, she would give him back to him. Her prayer shows that Hannah knew that Elkanah was not the source of children, but God was. She recognized that children are always a gift from God, perhaps one of his greatest gifts. Hannah prayed silently, moving only her lips. She wasn't praying to be heard by others. She was talking with God from the depths of her heart. And this caused Eli, the chief priest, to think she was drunk. For prayer in the ancient world was usually said aloud. But Eli had misjudged Hannah, for she had not been pouring herself a drink. Far from it. She was pouring her soul out to God. And we are told that God remembered her prayer. And in time she conceived and gave birth to a son, and Samuel came to be born. Before we go any farther, I realize that God does not always answer the prayers of barren couples in the way he did Hannah. I know that many couples who have prayed without ceasing that God would allow them to have children have not. And I don't know why some people are able to conceive easily while others are not. But I do know this. God understands the pain we go through, and I know he loves us and wants the best for us. He remembers our prayers just as he did those of Hannah. There comes a time in the midst of things that we don't understand when we simply have to trust God's heart. We simply need to trust in his overwhelming goodness. And that is what Hannah did. For when little Samuel was weaned, which in those days was probably between the age of 3 and 6. God, I imagine that. She fulfilled her vow and did what must have been very painful to her. She brought Samuel to the tabernacle at Shiloh to dedicate him to the Lord and left him with Eli to be raised as a priest. But she had 5 more children. I bet that put Peninnah in her place. And as I've said, Samuel grew up to become one of the most influential leaders in all of Israel's history. Under his leadership, Israel renounced idolatry and shook off the yoke of the Philistines. So here is Hannah, a woman whom God used to bring into being a man who became one of the greatest prophets of Israel. A man who would be the spiritual guide and mentor of the first 2 kings of Israel. When it came to mothering, Hannah did a good job. The first thing that made Hannah a great mother was the fact that she and her husband shared a deep devotion for each other. I mean, Hannah and Elkanah obviously had a great love of each other. Verse 5 of chapter 1 says, Elkanah gave Hannah a double portion of meat because of his love of her. And in verse 8, I can almost see him coming up behind his weeping wife and putting his arms around her as he draws attention to their greatest love by saying, do I not mean more to you than 10 sons? They were devoted to each other. You may ask, how does that relate to successful parenting? What's love got to do with it? And the answer to that is everything. The quality of the love between parents has a great deal of influence on how our children turn out. The greatest gift you can give your children is to love each other. If parents want to raise children who will grow up as godly adults, what greater example than to love one another? And I'm not just talking here about a feeling kind of love. I'm referring to a love that's visible in our actions, in the ways we relate to one another. I know of love between a man and a woman because I saw the example of my mother and father, who loved not just me, who was born to them, and my sister who was born to them, but 5 others who weren't, and gave them a home, gave them all that they needed, taught them about God and faith. John 1 says, we are to love one another not with words or tongue, but with actions and truth. If instead of love there is obvious hostility between parents, it casts a shadow of insecurity over children that we attempt to raise. But if, on the other hand, the parents' relationship is strong and affectionate, if it is characterized by the kind of noticeable devotion that Hannah and Elkanah had for each other, then it will create a sense of security and peace and well-being in the lives of children. Children need to know that mum and dad have something special. They need to see the affection you show for one another. It conveys the message that the marriage is good and solid. And when they see that you love one another in spite of disagreements, then they know that you love them with the same unconditional love. One writer puts it like this: spirituality is showing love when you feel like attacking, joy when you'd rather whine, peace when you'd rather argue, patience when you'd rather demand, kindness when you'd rather be cruel. The way we relate teaches our children how to relate. When parents deal with one another in a loving way, then their children are more likely to relate to each other and to their peers throughout life in a loving way. Remember how lovingly Elkanah treated Hannah. He saw her grief and related to her with empathy. In his actions, he showed a love that was patient and kind, that was the quality of loving devotion that was shown to Samuel in the early years. And Hannah also had a dedication to God. This too was something that she shared with her husband. Hannah and Elkanah not only loved each other, they also loved their God. And that was clearly shown in their actions. This man, Elkanah, would go up from his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Now, the word yearly doesn't mean that Hannah and Elkanah only went to worship once a year. It indicates they attended the festival referred to in verse 3. Once a year, and probably went a total of 3 times annually. So they could attend the other feasts and worship times held at the temple. And each time they went, it meant a round trip on foot, and probably took days. And they gave Samuel to the priest Eli. And they continued to make particular pilgrimages to the temple. Each year, Samuel's mother made him a little robe and took it to him when she went up with her husband for the annual sacrifice. A robe made with love for her son. Hannah's dedication to God was seen in her prayer life. She prayed for a son, and when God answered, she responded with a prayer of thanks. And this prayer apparently became well known amongst the Jewish nation. We know that, for Mary, the mother of Jesus, seems to have modeled her own prayer of thanks on the prayer of Hannah. Hannah and Elkanah had a faith in God that was deeply felt, genuinely believed, and clearly expressed in the actions of their lives. And again, you might ask, what does that have to do with parenting? And again, I would say everything. Because the quality of the relationship we have with God will influence our children's development. Children are always watching. They look to see if God is indeed real to you. They notice how much you pray. They see how often you apply the teachings of the Bible in your daily life. And they'll be the first to notice your hypocrisy. As somebody once said, if you don't live it, you don't believe it. Or if you don't live it, your children won't believe it. If you want your children to believe in God and live in ways that please Him, then you have to do so as well. Having a deep faith in God is not enough. We must model it to them. In family and in the church. You're not always going to hold on to your children. As some of you know, the day comes all too quickly when they'll be out on their own. And Hannah certainly discovered that earlier than one might have anticipated. She only had a few years with her son. So while we have them, we need to show the importance of knowing God personally. When the son Hannah had wanted for so long arrived, the future looked much brighter. And so she rejoiced. But her rejoicing was primarily in her renewed, personal situation, but in God. For his unique greatness and what he was doing in the world around her and for his people. And as she rejoiced, She challenges people to recognize who God is. And one of the questions Hannah's prayer asks of us is whether we're able to take the times of blessing that God pours out on us to transform them through prayer into good for the world around us. Does our experience of God in our life give us greater confidence that he will work powerfully in other situations in our lives? Two things to remember. Hannah's devotion to her husband, they were deeply in love, and her dedication to God. You know, we all want children to grow up and be happy and fulfilled. We all want the best for our children. In fact, we'll be willing to sacrifice so they have it. We want them to have the best homes, the best clothes, the best holidays, the best education. But if we give them all of this and do not guide them in a loving relationship with God, we've not really given them very much. Not all of our children will necessarily have a faith when they grow up, but they will know of it through your love and your actions. However, if they do have a faith and relationship with God and little else in life, you have given them everything. And it's the best thing that you can give yourselves. On this day of my mother's anniversary of her death, I give thanks for her and my father. My father was one of 14 children. Can you imagine it? A two-bedroom terraced house in Colchester and 14 children. My father said one Christmas, they had 28 people sleeping there. And remember, the toilet was down the bottom of the garden. And if he had a bath, it was a tin bath in front of the fire. He learnt something of the love of a mother who loved 14 as though there were only one to love. He learnt the love of a father who loved 14 as if there were only one to love. And he and my mother loved 7. Two of their own, and 5 who weren't. And although some of them don't have a faith in God, they know that love has been demonstrated to them. And they still know of a father who continues to demonstrate it to them today and will continue to do in the days ahead, I'm sure. Amen.